You're listening to the Yeshiva of Newark podcast. I'm your host and curator, Rabbi Avram Kivalevich, and I hope you enjoy this episode. In the summer of 2019, months before the COVID pandemic would fuel a massive expansion of podcast availability, an eventual acceptance of this medium even from the most conservative religious circles, the Yeshiva of Newark launched its platform, fusing an enlightened series of shiurim and contemporary topics presented uncompromisingly with serious interviews and dialogue with important figures in education, psychology, and mystical thought. The result shone important shafts of light on hitherto unnoticed problems and suggesting real solutions. During the global shutdown of in-person learning options and forced quarantines, hundreds of searchers across multiple time zones joined our Zoom live events every afternoon and evening. Sophisticated classes described the fundamentals of Talmud learning for adults who had been underserved. Scholarly old hands joined Shiurim and Yerushalmi and Dafyemi. We were at the forefront of producing Hespedim for so many stalwarts of Torah and Avoda who passed away during the height of the Magefa. These presentations brought comfort and appreciation to the bereaved of our people. The platform routinely chimed in on the relevant issues and upsetting scandals of the day from a rabbinic perspective. We even offered options for healthy, life-affirming entertainment in a world bowled over by streaming services. With downloads approaching the million mark and an archival library numbering in the thousands, the Yeshiva of Newark podcast has been striving to continuously upgrade our content, professionalize our audio sound, along with altering approaches in light of much appreciated listener feedback. I firmly believe that a niche has been carved out that resonates with many on the wide spectrum of observant Jews. This explains why we continually rank high in independent online lists of top yeshiva podcasts. This proud edifice I've described is in real danger of toppling and disappearing. We need the help of our listeners to continue to record and edit, to promote the product that has been a balm, an instructor to so many. Just $36 as a minimum donation from 1,000 of you out there will keep us afloat as a new arc of straight, intelligent, humorous discussion, lectures, debate, and inquiry, while the destructive waters of ignorance and identity politics, cyberbullying, crash around us. Your generous contributions will seal and galvanize this arc till it comes to a satisfying rest in an era of B'loi Ha'aretz Deya, heralding Mashiach, B'mheira, B'yameinu, Amen.
Hello, this is Schmoozing with Mayor Schiller, Mayor Kalman. It's with some hesitation that I begin our conversation today, Rabbi Mayor, because I think it's probably in the back of almost everyone who is aware of what's happening in the world, especially in Eretz Yisrael and in Gaza. Let me start just with the person who occupies the chair of the most powerful position in the world, the President of the United States. And he spoke last night, Joe Biden, from the day that we are recording this. And I'll just read a little bit about what he said. I know the last 5 months have been gut-wrenching for so many people, for the Israeli people, the Palestinian people, and so many here in America. The crisis began on October 7th with a massacre by the terrorist group Hamas. 1,200 innocent people, women and girls, men and boys slaughtered, many enduring sexual violence, the deadliest day for the Jewish people since the Holocaust. 250 hostages taken. Here in the chamber tonight, our American families whose loved ones are still being held by Hamas. Israel has a right to go after Hamas. Hamas could end this conflict today by releasing the hostages, laying down arms, and surrendering those responsible for October 7th. Israel has an added burden because Hamas hides and operates among the civilian population. But Israel also has a fundamental responsibility to protect innocent civilians in Gaza. This war has taken a greater toll on innocent civilians than all previous wars in Gaza combined. More than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of whom are not Hamas, Thousands and thousands are innocent women and children, girls and boys also orphaned. Nearly 2 million more Palestinians under bombardment are displaced. Homes destroyed, neighborhoods in rubble, cities in ruin, families without food, water, medicine. It's heartbreaking. Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza and ensure that humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. To the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution is a two-state solution. I say this as a lifelong supporter of Israel and the only American president to visit Israel in wartime. There's no other path that guarantees Israel's security and democracy. There is no other path that guarantees Palestinians can live with peace and dignity. There is no other path that guarantees peace between Israel and all of its Arab neighbors, including Saudi Arabia. Let me just make a couple points. I want to hear, you know, your response. First is that many people are up in arms in Israel, Palestinians, and Americans, right? This has become not just an issue that's local. It is consuming the whole country. And that's why in the State of the Union, he needed to speak about that this is something essential. But I think for all of us, and I would say all thinking Jews, the ideas and the images of the suffering of what's happening to the Palestinians is filtering through us, into us. And it's making many people uncomfortable and coming up with ways to understand. Biden said in the first sentence, Mayor, that Hamas could end this. But yet afterwards, what he ended up doing was basically browbeating Israel. And I think almost every thinking Jewish person who cares about his identity and a connection to this country has to somehow come to grips with this issue, not just in this war, but maybe even in a greater fashion than that. And to look again at the interconnection between Eretz Yisrael, Medinas Yisrael, and the Arab Palestinian neighbors that we have. And I know that you have written and thought about this.
You say every thinking person is troubled by this. I don't know if I agree with that. I think amongst most of Orthodox Jewry, they are all what Benjamin Brown, he's a professor at Hebrew U, he says most of Orthodox Jews are right-wing Zionists in their kishkas. In that, there is a certain overriding pessimism about the human condition in general, but certainly about the Islamic and Arab worlds. There's an overriding pessimism that these people or the human condition is essentially bad, and that the only way we can deal with or respond to it is to be strong and harsh, and that maybe somewhere down the road, somehow, this may change, but for the immediate future, the only possible response is what is now being done, or worse than that, more than that. And I travel between three worlds of Orthodoxy, the modern Orthodox and the Yeshivish and the Hasidish, and I think there's almost unanimity on this question, that they are all right-wing Zionists in their kishkas. They all feel that there is no peaceful possibility and that the only solution can be periodic harshness, or on the extreme right of that equation, it would be we're not harsh enough. We have to work towards transfer of populations and so forth. So there's this pessimism that overrides everything they say or do. If you would suggest that there is human suffering involved on the other side, well, that's the end of the conversation. How dare you raise that? How dare you discuss that?
I think there have been very measured and serious discussions and writing about civilian casualties and what could justify civilian casualties in war.
From Orthodox Jews?
Yes. Yeah. You might call them people who, you know, operate more in the modern liberal sphere, but they are yeshiva graduates. They are people who have written in Lashon HaKodesh scholarly articles in various journals, and I can refer our listeners to them. One of them is my friend Arya Clapper, who operates out of Boston. The other is Michael Broyd.
You don't think that Rabbi Clapper is an example of typical Orthodox?
No. And I didn't say typical. I said, there are many. I didn't say the percentage is large compared to normative Orthodoxy, but it is happening. And I think even those that you say are in their Kishkas, right-wing Zionists, they still have to think in their minds, what about what we're saying? Yes, we're not talking about the yahoos that are blocking the streets and hanging from the rafters and conflating trans rights with the Palestinian rights. And you can talk about that a little bit later. But in their mind, they have to say, it's Hamas's fault. Yes, I cry over those deaths of those children. When I see the images that have been reported, even this morning by the Associated Press, the number of children dying of malnutrition, of dysentery that are dying, I cannot just be heartless and say, yeah, they deserve to die, but I blame it on Hamas's attack. And therefore, Hamas, can you please stop? Can you please surrender? I don't think that they are just cold and heartless and saying, they deserve worse. We should perhaps obliterate them. I think that would be painting things with a much too harsh brush.
Okay. Leave that as it might be. The question is really a far deeper question. So we'll leave aside what the near unanimous opinion of Orthodoxy is or it's not.
Right.
Okay, we can leave that for later. But then there is the real question of where does the truth lie here in terms of what rights do a people have? What is a people? The Israelis are dealing with a situation, and leave alone Gaza for the moment, but take the West Bank, for example, in which you rule over hundreds of thousands of people, and you do not allow them to participate in the normative electoral process of your country. Now, of course, the Israeli response is going to be, we can't, we simply can't. And therefore, we must proceed as we are. But if that's the position, and I'm not saying right now whether it's right or wrong, but if that's the position, then there's going to be an endless struggle for self-determination on the part of the Palestinians. And they're going to argue that they are no different than any other indigenous people that has been set upon by a colonial power. And in the rest of the world, and we'll get to the question of whether Israel is different, but in the rest of the world, that has been the norm over the past century or 75 years, that the colonial settler population is viewed as wrong and evil and worthy of a military assault and worthy of a military assault on civilians, whether it was Algeria, Kenya, Ghana, Rhodesia, South Africa, all these places, the world's sentiment is with the indigenous peoples seeking self-determination. Now, one more point. There are two other examples on the table of this. One is America, where the indigenous peoples have largely faded from the scene. And then you have, I think, Australia and New Zealand, where the indigenous peoples are now coming to the surface, the Aboriginal tribes of Australia, the Maori in New Zealand, and they're making a tumult as to what has happened to them and with them. So what's happened is Israel has got caught here in sort of a time warp in which the world has gone somewhere else, and they view Israel as they view all these other colonial powers. There are several distinctions which can be made between, let's say, Israel and the French in Algeria. They had obviously Eden have a Shaychus to Eretz Israel that goes back, thousands and thousands of years. There was no military conquest until there was a military Palestinian opposition. There were land purchases, by which we acquired the land. And there is no mother country. In other words, when Belgium comes to the Congo, it's being done largely or somewhat, depending on how you learn Pshat, for the sake of Belgium. And Kenya is being ruled somewhat for the sake of England. But the Israelis in Eretz Yisrael are ruling for themselves in the place where they are, which makes it somewhat similar, I think, to the American model. Now, at this point, there are a host of very angry Israeli responses, and every Jew and every Beis Medrash will give them to you. Well, they have 100 other countries, and they're killing people, and this and that. No, they don't have 100 other countries. They see themselves as indigenous to this country. And for the use of terror, my response to a lot of this is, you know, the use of terror was the means that the Third World achieved political power. How else could they achieve? How else could the FLN have gotten the French out of Algeria? Could they have come out and fight fair? So let me explain. I'm not judging any side of this question here. I understand the story from many different perspectives. And, you know, as the Islamic world or the Third World or the majority of mankind at this point will say, this didn't start on October 7th. You have to go back to the 1890s. You have to go back to the 1920s. And you have to view it from the perspective of the people living there, who were at that time 90, 95% of the population. So they see themselves as being put upon by these outsiders. And as one Palestinian once said, he said, if the Jews suffered in Russia or Germany, why is that my father's fault? Why does he have to give up his home? So again, very complex questions on many, many sides. But my final point is this. There are three solutions on the table. And forget about the current war. There are three solutions on the table. Either make real war, make real peace, or just be macabre. This is the way things are going to be, as long as America is sort of the signing Israelis' checks. So it's going to go on like this, a terror, counter-terror, a war every now and then, blow-ups on the West Bank, car rammings, stabbings, shootings, and it's going forever, which is what I said to you a few months ago when we started this, maybe an intractable conflict. And that sort of is, I think, if you would ask the average Israeli, I think that's what they would say. The average Israeli does not want to have a two-state solution. The average Israeli does not want to transfer the Palestinians out of the West Bank and Gaza. The average Israeli says, Nebuch, this is the Metzius. We're stuck with it.
Yeah, that's a lot to respond to. And I am not as well-versed in the revolutionary movements as you are. I've come to read a lot about them in light of the fact that they have been evoked to explain the almost worldwide condemnation of Israeli actions, especially the works of Franz Fanon, the author of White Masks, Black Skins, and The Wretched of the Earth. It is a very horrible book to read in many ways. The prose has been described as beautiful. I'll just read a little sample of it for you, for our listeners, and tell me if you don't think this sounds like, you know, a beautiful kibbutz compared to the squalor in Gaza. The settler's town is built to last, all stones and steel. It's a brightly lit town with paved roads where garbage cans are always filled with unknown remains never seen. The town of the colonized, the Negro town, the Medina, the reservation, is a disreputable place inhabited by disreputable men. You're born anywhere, anyhow. You die anywhere, from anything. And of course, Fanon was, he exalted the fact that violence would be used to bomb the French settlers in Algeria. He saw that as the breath of life emanating from these oppressed people. And therefore, it really explains why so many supposedly moral and liberal feeling groups applauded what happened on October 7th. Because they saw it, as you said, Reb Meir, as not just a terrorist attack that was Nazism once again resurfacing, but rather as something that has been waiting and has been exploding in little cracks, but maybe never as effectively since 1948, since the Nakba, and as you say, maybe even going back earlier. So yes, I think a lot here depends, as you imply, where do we start this discussion? Do we start it from October 7th? You feel that that is a short-sighted way to look at it.
It's a short-sighted way in terms of the overall conflict.
Yes, yes. Do we start it from the Nakba of 1948? Or do, as you said earlier, from the Aliyah Rishona or the Aliyah Shnia that began the more serious Aliyah that happened in the 1890s, where the land started being bought up and the Yishuvim started being developing, and there was already the sense that the things were happening?
I'm going to suggest another date, I think, here. I'm going to say in the 1830s, there was an Egyptian attempt to sort of liberate that area from Ottoman rule. And a lot of the local leaders of that rebellion, Palestinian, they wouldn't be called Palestinian in those days. The name was born later. But those people living in that area who assisted that Egyptian attempt to throw off Ottoman rule are looked back very often as the founders of Palestinian nationalism. So again, there is a sense of growing awareness of a desire for independence among the Arab peoples living in Eretz Yisrael going back to the 1830s.
One of the reasons why, we talked earlier about how the normative yeshiva world can deflect this, is because we see that this is not a imperialist presence, but rather it is a divine presence. And I just want to talk a little bit about it, about the sort of incredible trick that Americans are able to do. You mentioned before about how it is, you know, you have settlers who came thousands of miles across an ocean, whether it was systematic or not. They eventually, within a few hundred years, had massacred, displaced, pretty much eliminated the indigenous persons in this country. But the idea that, you know, we should cede the country back to its original inhabitants, the ones that we swindled, slaughtered, lied to, put down in every possible way, is never really suggested. And so Americans, we live in the bounty of this country. And if you think about, you know, the Fanon's descriptions of the settlers' towns, that describes small town America, beautiful pride in the country. When Biden enters those chambers and Hail to the Chief is sung and everyone stands up for the United States, it's all a country that was built on, we had a right to be here. It started with religious freedom, and then it morphed into almost a very biblical type of perception that we are the chosen, and that right. American is chosen. This is God's will. I mentioned this to you yesterday, and we talked about what we're going to talk about today. Kivshu Reduas Haaretz, that became the idea of what, you know, Andrew Jackson and basically all the American troops were about. We are going to put the savages down. We are going to cleanse the country. This is God's gift to us. The fact that the fact that Plymouth Rock, they were able to survive that winter, was the Gilui Hashchina that we were supposed to stretch from the Atlantic to the Pacific and take off everything. And this was what we were all fed as children.
Sure. But I think we have to add another point here. The world changed in terms of regarding a hierarchy of peoples. And you can still get this a little bit when an Israeli defender will say, well, we brought them this and we brought them that, and they should really be grateful to us. You'll still hear that a little bit on the Israeli side, the sense there are certain civilized peoples and there are certain uncivilized peoples, and that the civilized peoples have a greater claim to rule because they will rule more efficiently for everyone. And that's a viewpoint which was standard in European civilization as regards third world peoples, and today is regarded as very evil. So I say again, the Israelis are caught up in that old worldview of chosen peoples, superior peoples, better peoples. And when they say, oh, well, we can't deal with them, we tried, but they're just so violent and they're just so bloodthirsty, we cannot deal with them, would have been the same way that an American settler or an Australian settler or an Afrikaner settler would have said the same things. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not true, but it does mean that idea has fallen into disrepute. It is very possible that, I don't know, let's say Kenya or Zimbabwe were better off under European rule, but this is a forbidden thought.
Rav Kook Zatzal wrote in letters written in the beginning of the 20th century to a young fellow who was troubled by the institution of slavery that is not only talked about in the Torah, but is basically at length extolled, even to the point of the pasuk of La'olam Bahem Tavoidu, that it's usur to be meshachrer an eved. You're not allowed to free a non-Jewish slave who has accepted a mantle of subservience and what we would call semi-kedusha as part of Klal Yisrael. He has to stay that way. You can't free him. That's right. Right. So Rav Kook Zatzal explained this as for the betterment of those people, again, saying clearly that the world since the time of Shem, Chum, and Yafes has been divided into persons who are innately in their identity barbaric, and therefore they could gain from serving our tables. They could gain from watching from the servants' quarters through the small window how elevated, respectful people act and absorb that, and it would change them. And this was what Rav Kook wrote, and he said that this is for the toiva of those peoples. Those peoples need to, in a way, and that doesn't mean that you take the whip out and you lash them to the point that they bleed. You need to have rachmanis on your property. And then Rav Kook evoked what was happening in Europe, and I'm talking specifically in the British Isles, the various coal mine disasters of workers that, because of desperation, were being sent into mines that were dangerous, and there were a number of cave-ins. And Rav Kook bemoaned this and said, you know, if you think your capitalist system, your system of freedom is so much better, if those wealthy owners of the mines would own the property, would own the humans, they would never allow them to go into a dangerous hellhole in order to bring out this desired earth or desired metal.
It's an old Southern slavery argument back in the pre-Civil War days. Oh, sure, that the factory worker in a northern city, he has no social security, has no medical care. He says, when a slave grows old, he's cared for. When a slave gets sick, he's cared for because he is our property. So it's not just Rav Kook.
When Biden and others and Trump, whoever it is, chest thump about the great city on the hill and the greatest hope for the world, they are selecting parts of what the founding fathers and others might have written and saying the other part is obviously things we reject as a world that has moved on. However, we're not ready to cede all the benefits that barbaric world gave to us. We're just ready to lecture in a State of the Union address about what Israel has to do to its population. They are going beyond most of what you hear in any war situation that's ever been described. Israel has been subject to fighting a war with its hand tied behind its back.
Well, because mankind would say that the real solution here is two states for two peoples. That's what the world would say. And the fact that you have refused to do that, now, of course, the Israelis are going to say here, they have agreed to that. The Israelis are going to say that whether it's the Peel Commission, whether it's the 1948 partition plan, whether it's Camp David in 2000, the Israelis are always going to say, we did agree and they did not agree. And therefore, the fact they still want to fight us militarily leaves us no choice but to use violent methods to suppress them. But here's what they would say in response. I'm not coming to a conclusion here, but they would say the following, that the Peel Commission, the petition plan, all that stuff was monstrously unfair because they were the vast majority of the population, and they agreed to one democratic state where everybody votes. So they would say we've been invaded by these peoples, and oh yeah, divided. You brought them in and you invaded us, divided. So that's why they would say they rejected it. To which the Jews would, of course, say, "But wait a minute, we were Hitler and Russia and this and that, and where are we supposed to go? We have nowhere to go." So
right. So I think the appeal to Rachmanis, the appeal that we are the Holocaust victims, or even the pogrom victims, or the Tsarist victims, right. is sure. an argument that ultimately withers away. It was strong at the time because we had the Jews had international sympathy, but I think as many Frum thinkers said after the October 7th events, the left in Israel has to own up to the divine responsibility and the connection that we have in Eretz Yisrael based on the Torah and based on the Rabbeinu Shalom. And that is something which cannot, as believing Jews, we are convinced, correct, that this is the center of the universe even, but definitely the center of the earth and the place that Klal Yisrael will achieve its self-actualization. And this is the only place that can happen. And if there happens to be Palestinians that are there based on ultimately Arab conquest, Muslim conquests that occurred 1,300 years earlier, well, Dar al-Islam has to be thrown into the garbage heap in order for the Shechina to return.
Yeah, but they're not just going to accept that. So then you fight forever. In other words, if that's true, that we have a divine imperative, and they've only been there for 1,300 years, it's okay. That's it. Fight and kill each other forever. But that's what you're saying. Understand that's what you're saying. But you're saying implicitly, no?
Right, right. So what I'm saying is that if the divine imperative is true, then the whole picture of the divine imperative has to be embraced. The idea of a country for Jewish identity, as opposed to a country for Jewish life, of religious right. life, of Torah mm-hmm. life. In yeah. other words, a embracing of Torah mitzvahs. Right. In other words, if it's all, which is really what Mizrahi and the other movement said, it's Am Yisrael, Torah Yisrael, Be'eretz Yisrael. It's right, all right. really bound together. If you separate an aspect of that, then you're right. You are going to have to suffer the slings and arrows of the more than outrageous fortune that overcomes you. If we believe in the Rabbeinu Shalom, believe that God, we are God's people, and that the attack on October 7th was part of God's message, and it was a message, then it should lead to a stronger connection to God, which we thought we were seeing.
Are you saying therefore what? Therefore they should submit?
What I'm saying is that when we are all operating in that theater, whether the Palestinians or the rest of the world are not, I believe, and again, this is a mystical, illogical point that probably can't be substantiated based on what's been happening. But I believe that is where our Hatzol is going to come from. I think the Rabbeinu Shalom, and again, go back to my first statement, the Rabbeinu Shalom doesn't expect us to be ostriches and to not care about those children that are dying and those starving individuals. Again, you paint a very pessimistic picture of what's going to happen afterwards. You know, I think I told you even at the time when we were speaking so many months ago, and I was calling you, I was speaking to you from a Yerushalayim hotel that was full of refugees, that if there is a Iberkerenish, which means like a revolutionary change in accepting God and the mitzvahs and what is our role for humanity And that includes, of course, diktuk and Torah mitzvahs and tveikus derban shalom being or lilagoyim, that the mire will somehow dissipate.
They will then submit to us?
The Rabbeinu Shalom, look, there are fickle incidents in history that cannot be described just based on Marxian or other theories. You also agree that you see the Yad Hashgacha in the world, right? There are, whether, you know, he is the Baal Milchamos. It's ugly and it's terrible. Yeah. I'm with you. However, I believe that, you know, the Rabbeinu Shalom can be misalik that. I don't know what methods, I don't know what methods are going to happen, but yes, as long as we sort of deny our, not only our divine role, but our divine responsibility. It's not just that we are the greatest and we are supposed to conquer and be a model, but we have great responsibilities and work to do in order to actualize who we are. We have to be medactic in Kriya Shema, to medactic in our speech and in our Shmiras Einayim. We have to live the way God wants us to live. You are older than I, but can you remember another event like October 7th since in your lifetime when 1,200 Jews were slaughtered? Don't you believe that this is a wake up call, and that what's dependent, what is really incumbent upon us to do is to wake up and change through it?
Here's the only thing I would say. I'd say, listen, the demographics in Eretz Yisrael are such that you're going to have your Orthodox state. So, okay, just sit back and wait, and then it'll be and you'll have right wing religious Zionists running the country. So then you'll have Shemina Satayra.
It isn't so much, the state is only secondary to the purpose. In other words, you're right. If it's all about the state, but the state is an Orthodox one, then we get into trouble.
Which is what it will be.
Right, but let's put it the other way, that Orthodox or Frumkeit or Dveikus to God is number one. God is saying, look, I let this happen to you. Come back to me. You know what you need to do. Then the statecraft and that aspect will follow. If our main purpose is having control and running things efficiently, but in an Orthodox way where things are closed on Shabbos and it's glatt kosher everywhere, then it's only a detail that sort of makes us equal to all the neighbors around us. But if number one is the Rabbeinu Shalom, number one is Dveikus to God, and knowing that being in this country is the ultimate way to achieve that, so then the statecraft aspect, I think, is secondary. And again, I invoke Rav Kook because I know that is the way he thought. He was not a fiery Mizrachist. He actually felt the Mizrahi Chevra had taken things too far. They were too caught up in these details. I can't write on a piece of paper a steps that will occur, because I think those steps are ultimately from God.
Right. So you are saying then, for the short term, we just muddle through with terror and counter terror and war and counter war.
I would say, since what I am talking about is clearly not happening.
No, it is. It is slowly but surely, what you're saying. How can it be avoided? The demographics are that this is going to be a religious state. So short term, you know, before we become either Meimad or Hoyali Aguda or whatever your desired end here is, so we're just stuck with a terrible situation on both sides.
Would you say at this point, I mean, and you sort of are implying that the continued assault is really going to harm us spiritually, physically, diplomatically? You would, if you were part of the war council, if you were in that room with Benny Gantz, what would be your advice?
To just one preliminary answer, he said, physically, spiritually, diplomatically. So I would say the current approach is certainly bad physically, because it yields endless wars and terror. I'd say spiritually, because it renders us blind to the millions of people amongst whom we live on a daily basis, and diplomatically, because America is not always going to be what America is today. As America changes demographically, which is inevitable, then America is not going to be giving speeches like Biden gave last night. So I'd say in all three standards that you raise, it's no solution. It just makes things worse. What should be done, again, if you push me to a corner and I was there, I have not yet given up on some kind of reconciliation. Now, do you want to blow up Gaza for another couple of weeks? What's the difference? It doesn't matter. In other words, all that's going to do is maybe forestall some terror for the immediate future, but it's not going away. The problem is not going away. You have 2 million people in Gaza. You have 3 million people in the West Bank. You have who knows how many millions. It's not going away. So you ask me, what do I think? I think you have to try and figure it out, or else reconcile to this reality and stop crying. In other words, the constant crying, oh, they're killing us, they're hating us. Yeah, of course they are. Because now you say, I can't deal with them. Okay, so you can't deal with them. So they'll kill each other. And I'm not saying that in a denigrating sense. I'm just saying, realize that's what you're saying. Realize that if there is no hope, if all we can do is bomb Gaza every couple of years, which it's all we've done now for 20 years is bomb Gaza every couple of years. If that's all we can do, then okay, then we're stuck. Then we're stuck. Maybe we are. But have the courage to say that. Every time Israel gets involved in these things, the Israeli prime minister or some general, if he will show them they cannot succeed. Yeah, that's true. You have shown them they cannot succeed, but you haven't shown them they shouldn't keep trying. We will show them they cannot. Please, we're doing this 75 years already. So have you ever solved the problem?
One thing that I think Netanyahu said, and of course it's been said by others, but when he wrote a essay in the Wall Street Journal, sort of writing a defense of what Israel's approach was, he mentioned that this what really was needed was a 20, 25-year view of re-educating the Palestinian people. And this has been, I think, shown beyond a doubt that the Palestinian kids have been raised on hatred of the oppressor, and that there is a abject hatred that permeates the community.
As all the rest of the third world.
Right. So in other words, that won't change unless they get a state. It's impossible to impose.
Where did it change? Where in the whole world did the colonial project succeed, except in those places where it was successful before the world changed, as in America, as in New Zealand and Australia, but they're not settled yet. But where did it go away? Where did they stop saying we want a country?
You do agree that it isn't just about having our state. You do agree from the river to the sea means that we're going to get rid of this European Israeli presence and we're going to get back with the whole country.
I think it varies, and I think the statement is unclear, but let's say yes. I'll say yes.
So
therefore you're going to educate them. Again, I want to know where this education is going, because right-wing religious Zionism will not say we're going towards two states. It'll never say that.
Yeah, I am just saying to look at what could happen if it's true that Hamas is eliminated.
Whatever that means. Religious political philosophy that is over 100 years old is going to be eliminated. Go ahead.
No, but let's assume that the thinkers, planners, commanders are gone.
Writers, poets, philosophers, and songwriters as well.
You're right. They can write manifestos and songs everywhere, and it can always be posted. But assuming that what Netanyahu said is possible, that there is a educational change, that they're not the mother's milk is not the poison that killed the Jew when you grow up, and that is not even the most extreme religious Zionist, that we have to kill every Arab.
No, just rule over them.
Yes. It's not to kill them. It's not that we have to kill them.
Well, if they pick up their heads and fight against us, we will kill them. Right. We rule over them, and if they raise their heads, we kill them.
You know, we cannot ignore, Rameyer, the fact that we are standing at the cusp of Chodesh Adar, and I mentioned this to you the other day, that the holiday that is the shining center of Chodesh Adar and is the launch pad to Geula is a holiday that is built on the death of our enemies. Now, it's interesting when we think about it, the Persian hegemony and control of 127 satraps or different countries was an example of colonialism in its greatest fashion, a benign colonialism. Cyrus the Great, Kairos allowed service in the Beis HaMikdash. He would have allowed it had it not been stopped, but eventually he and his descendants agreed to this, even Ahasuerus, Daryovish. In other words, you can serve, you're under Persian rule, but Persian rule, and again, as Joseph Klausner has pointed out, based on the Zoroastrian mentality, you can almost take every religion and see the dualism of good versus evil, and we'll let them do this. They're going to pay us taxes. They're going to have their place. They're even going to have an element of self-government. So you have a country, a giant superpower that is very amenable to other little countries. We throw big parties for them. And then you have, of course, in Purim, you have the call to eliminate, what we would call genocide today, a people. It wasn't that I think the Persian military, for whatever, however strong that was called to destroy anybody who identified as a Jew or identified as Yehudim, but it was a permission for the enemies that already existed. And you have to wonder, were they all Amalekim? I mean, again, this is a very strange phenomena, but here it was, possible genocide. And here you have the Jews responding. And basically we glory in the fact that we killed, right? That we killed people and we won the war. It's Mechias Amalek. And I told you the other day that my students who came from conservative schools and other places to the Ida Crown Academy had a trouble celebrating this holiday when it was built on, the elimination of people, the elimination of our enemies, the killing of our enemies totally and completely. So what does Mechias HaMolek and Chag HaPurim have to tell us about the present day, if anything?
Well, who is Amalek here?
You know as well as I do that the Briskers, quoting Rav Chaim, Rav Yoshe Ber as well from Boston, that Yerushalmi that says, Misha Osa Maisa Amalek is Amalek, right? Despite the fact that Sancheirev Boy Ubilbo Ko Arotzeis and has made discovering who is really a descendant of that original, warmongering people almost impossible, the Yerushalmi seems to say that there's sort of like this demonic spirit that when it takes over, you now sort of become the Amaleki. Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yoshe Ber, that is, tried to give some sort of explanation to this of what his grandfather had said. And he said that if the hatred doesn't seem to have any ancillary cause, that if it's just because you are who you are, and it's self-destructive hatred.
So that's not relevant here. That's not relevant here, is it?
In other words, as you can see, it's as economists have said, that had Hitler and the Nazis not devoted so much attention to the elimination of the Jews, they could have really perhaps survived the Allied blitz and could have eked out some sort of victory. But because of all the efforts that they put into mass extermination, they really sealed their fate.
But that's not the Palestinians, is it? I don't know. If you'll call the FLN and you call ZANU and ZAPU and Rhodesia and you call the United Spear, whatever it was in South Africa, okay, I'll live with it. But you don't do that anywhere else in the whole world.
You know already that with Purim approaching, people who are in the grips of shock and horror and are upset about the war, they're going to point once again to the events of October 7th and seeing Sinwar as the modern-day Haman.
Again, we go back over ground. If Jomo Kenyatta and Ben Bella are Amalekim, yeah, but they're not. It's only here that you invoke this because it's only with Jews.
when you look at it from the perspective of, you know, Klal Yisrael, these are the ones who are fighting you, the ones who are fighting God. Let's be straightforward. A band of Jews that are traveling in the desert, that are being attacked, and let's say, yes, they attacked the weakest part of them, and they were fighting them. If you do not put the Torah's description of that milchama, it is a boring little skirmish that happened continuously in the ancient world. Here are these people traveling in the desert. We don't want them to come into the lands where we are. Let's attack these bastards and kill them, right? And then the Jews fighting, not miraculously, Yoshua leads a band of warriors and they fight. It happens to be Moshe Rabbeinu's on top of a mountain, somehow lifting up his hands. And then God takes that little description and says, this is the template of the milchama with Amalek Lador Vador. They're fighting me. This is a fight against God, and the world can never be a pure world until we get rid of these guys. Yes, those aren't Amalek because they're not trying to kill us. They're not trying to kill Klal Yisrael. They are not fueled by, you are a Jew and I'm killing you because you're a Jew.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to a previous point of the discussion. I'm going to say like this. I will live with our conclusion being, if we were what we are supposed to be as a people, then God will be in our assistance. And whatever that means, what we are supposed to be as a people, then we will fulfill our destiny and God will be helping us.
What's interesting is that even though we beat back the Amalekim, whoever they were, that attack on Purim, it's unlike what's happening here because, you know, it's Eretz Yisrael gets thrown in there just not to embarrass them. But basically, this has nothing to do with sovereignty. It has nothing to do with a control. We go back to being like Avdei Achashverosh Haaman, right? Isn't that what the Gemara says in Megillah? We go back to we beat back the assault, and there was no coalescing of any power afterwards. So, you know, yes, we celebrate the fact that we survive, there was a attempt to destroy us, but it didn't necessarily lead directly to sovereignty or control or domination of whoever it was that was trying to control us, right? It was basically, hey, you know, ubebiza lo sholchu es yodam, right? There was
now we do have that, you're saying.
Yes, that's my point. My point is that Purim, in one way, I think for many is a somehow, you see, here's Amalek today. On the other hand, Purim has other messages, right? You know, Hoder Kiblua b'mei Achashverosh. Yeah, but there was no direct difference in terms of control. So again, you know, I'm not trying to be evasive. I'm actually trying to strengthen your point. Hirsch basically takes Melchemes Amalek and spiritualizes it, that it's the spirit, not like Soloveitchik said, that it'll inhabit people again, but it's basically the ideas of power, the ideas of oppression. And again, Hirsch invents it out of cloth because his knowledge of who Amalek is basically based on, you know, his knowledge of European history, right? He doesn't know anything about Amalek, but he says, but the Zecher of Amalek, what Amalek stands for, the ideals, right? And again, all of this it's not Mefurish anywhere.
Hirsch always wants to humanize things.
Right, and therefore he cannot sanction that there really is a mitzvah to kill and destroy all these people.
One of our major problems is virulent anti-Gentilism, whoever it might be. And if we do tshuva on that, maybe you'd be right.
I will second that idea and say that the Megillah really calls for that. As much as the enemy, you know, mihu zev ezehu, there is also a clear distinction between the Charvona and even Achashverosh. You know, Rabbi Yosef says that, you know, Godel, when he talks about the fact that, you know, Mordechai goes down in respect after, you know, in the eyes of the Chachamim, Rabbi right. Yosef says, Godel Talmud Torah Yosef me'atzalas nefashos. So they understood that he was being Isaac and Atzalas Nefashis.
Even the Quisling Achashverosh is not subject to war crimes trials. So
yes, and the country functioning is being Matzil Nefashis, not necessarily just Jewish Nefashis. It's Atzalas Nefashis Mamish. So again, I think it is something that I think I think both of us agree that don't allow yourself to fall prey to the easy similarities that Purim is going to suggest to many. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please take a moment to share this or any of the many episodes available on our platform with friends in order to help grow our community. Until next time, Shalom.